The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
I help people every day to improve their health. Sometimes they've had lifelong issues or not fully recovered after a stressful event. The doctors have often run out of ideas. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. My name is Kirsten Hartwig, and this is the Herbal Medicine Show, brought to you by Heartwood Herbal Education. In today's show, we're going back in herbal history. We hear Sarah Atkinson talk about the herbs she found in the drains of the medieval Sutra Monastery near Edinburgh. Keith Robertson invites us into the world of Celtic herbal traditions and philosophy. And Nicola Kelly tells us about the Welsh herbal traditions practiced by the famous physicians of Medway. Welcome to your weekly dose of plant power. I found Sarah Atkinson because I know she knows about the history of herbal medicine, and one particular part of the history, which is up on the Scottish borders. And are you with us, Sarah? Hello.
Hello, yes, I am.
Are you at the Scottish borders at the moment, or where do you...
Well, no, I'm in Cumbria, which is not... Well, it depends where you draw the line, and that's kind of why at the time this monastery at Sutra was active.
This is the monastery you're going to tell us about. It is called the...
Sutra.
It's the Sutra Monastery.
Augustinian Monastery at Sutra.
And you've written a book about that called A Window on Medieval Medicine, which sounds really interesting. Because you're giving the date on the book from 1150 and up to 2018, so that's a pretty long stretch.
obviously the monastery wasn't active for all that time. It was the original sort of foundation stones were placed, we think, about 1150. And it was active for 400 years.
Wow, gosh. 400 years.
Yeah, pretty much.
And who were it was kind of a hospital, and also, who were the monks?
They were the Augustinian monks who established not long after St. Augustine sort of set up his branch of Christianity, I think, with his sister, because he set up a monastery and she set up a nunnery, I think, in Europe somewhere, a little bit vague. So this was established not long after, you know, he began to really sort of lay down his ideas for how Christianity, or an enclosed order of Christian monks, should behave. And one of those concepts was healing the sick. So that's why this is a particularly significant monastery from a herbal or a medical point of view, because next to what is probably, or was probably, the infirmary, is a very large drain.
Okay, and that's the drain you have been researching.
Well, yes, I mean, the archaeologist, or Brian Moffat, has done excavations, or been excavating the drain and looking at his finds for over 30 years. So I don't think he's done any digging for quite a long time, but there was so much material that came out of the drains, there's plenty for him to still be working on.
I can't help wondering, why did they have such big drains there?
Well, I guess if you had a small drain, it would block up really quickly. And there was everything went into it, so all human waste, so urine, excrement, blood. The Augustinians were really keen on bloodletting. So a tremendous amount of blood in the drain. So it was just the main waste collection point for the whole monastery, which at its height probably covered over 40 acres.
40 acres?
Yeah. That includes cultivated farmland as well as buildings.
It's called the Sutra Monastery. Why is it called Sutra?
Well, it's on Sutra Hill.
Okay.
So was the hill called Sutra before the monastery, or did the monastery give it its name? I really don't know. But what's quite interesting is the hill is 1,100 feet up. So it's the same height as St. Bernard's Pass in Switzerland. And it gets a lot of snow, and it's really a very much high point looking down onto Edinburgh.
Uh-huh.
But the surrounding land at approximately that height, because obviously it falls away, is really lush. It's got, when I've been there quite a few times, whoever owns it at the moment, whichever farmer farms it, the grassland comes right up to the drain, if you like, of Sutra. But when you go down lower, the land becomes more like moorland or fell. So you can kind of see the area that the monks cultivated because it is so abundant. It grows so much grass.
How interesting. And what did you find, because the subtitle of your book is The Drains at Sutra Monastery Give Up Their Herbal Secrets. So what did you find, apart from blood and urine?
Well, exactly, a huge amount of blood. I mean, I'm not the archaeologist, so Brian dug it all up and dusted it off. But the sort of things that were found, it's quite a lot of poppy seeds, opium mm-hmm. poppy.
Okay.
So clearly that was something that they used quite a lot.
They must have, did they? Do you think they did operations and used opium as a painkiller?
Yeah, there's quite a long tradition, a long history of the use of dwale, and the remnants in this drain sort of back that up. So dwale is a blend of, it can be anything from 3 to 6 or more herbs, but the main ingredients are poppy, opium poppy, henbane and hemlock, and these herbal remains have been found in this drain.
Wow, that's heavy-duty herbs as well, isn't it?
Those very heavy-duty herbs.
You have to be careful with them.
Well, you know, in those days, health and safety, what can we say? It was in a war zone. So I guess the patients didn't have too much to say. You know, if there's an amputation needed, they had to act quickly. And the way they used to administer this particular mixture, so they'd boil it up. They'd get the ingredients in the correct proportions, and they would boil it until it became something like a syrup
mm-hmm.
Or even a tar. So this would then last for a long time. And then when it was needed, a small amount would be reconstituted. They'd add water to it. And then a sponge would be soaked in it. And this would be put in the mouth of the patient. Now, whether the sponge was soaked in it or whether this mixture was actually dripped onto the sponge depends which source you look.
Uh-huh.
That. I think if you dripped the mixture onto the sponge, you'd have more of an accurate dose.
Yeah, so then the patient would obviously bite on that while they were trying to...
Yeah, and they would, well...
Be operated on without anaesthetic. What?
It would send them to sleep.
Yeah, okay, wow.
And they would go into this really deep sleep where then... I think mainly amputations were the operation. That was kind of the operation that was performed most often. It was the border between Scotland and England, which was constantly shifting.
Uh-huh.
And it's within sight of the Battle of Bannockburn. So, yeah, so there would be lots of people coming and passing through because the Royal Road from London to Edinburgh passes right by Sutra.
Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
So there would be a tremendous amount of number of travellers as well as soldiers.
Yeah, okay.
So lots of opportunity to
So
try
what
this.
Else did they treat, do you think? What could you see from the herbs you found? What else did they, apart from amputations and
pain-killing? Yeah, a lot of pain-killing. I mean, there is an antidote to it. They would have kept the patient unconscious for 24, 36 hours, and then they would have used vinegar as the antidote to bring them round.
How interesting.
And that's quite clever, because what often happens these days is your body can be quite shocked if there's a limb amputated. But if you're kept unconscious for quite a long time, then it allows the body to adapt a bit. That's the theory.
How interesting.
Also, holy fire, ergot poisoning seems to have been treated quite a lot with.
And ergot, that's what you get from rye, isn't it?
Exactly.
That is
kind of
moldy.
Rye.
So I suspect there was Might have been a bit of that around at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Scotland's always had a damp, cold climate. What ergot does, it constricts the circulation to the extremities, which is why it's known as holy fire, because it feels like your hands and feet are on fire.
Uh-huh.
And if you see medieval paintings, you'll see flames coming out of people's hands.
Yes, I have seen that. Is that what it's about?
Holy fire.
Uh-huh. And what did they do to
They used opium again, but also rose. Rose seems to have cropped up quite a lot as a sort of cooling, soothing ointment.
So rose oil or what?
Rose oil.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, St. Anthony was the monastic branch that really sort of nailed a treatment, hence a name called, you know, St. Anthony's Fire, because they... If you wanted treatment, if you went to that particular organisation of monks, they were very good at treating it. But it looks like it was treated also at Sutra, so that there are remnants of rose oil or roses and definite ergot, presence of ergot. But also in the drain, there's ergot combined with juniper.
Oh.
And that, we suspect, would have been to facilitate childbirth.
Okay.
Juniper is a uterine stimulant.
Yeah, but why ergot? Why ergot?
Well, ergot stops bleeding.
Oh, of course.
So if somebody's hemorrhaging, I mean, one dose of ergot doesn't cause holy fire or ergot poisoning.
Uh-huh.
And actually, ergotamine is used in hospitals now if there's hemorrhaging during childbirth. I mean, I think there are other drugs available, but it has been used for many years to stem hemorrhaging during childbirth.
How interesting. And then, of course, juniper to get the birth going.
Absolutely, to stimulate those uterine contractions. So quite interesting in a monastery.
Yes, isn't
it? I mean, obviously they were treating lay people, but then there's that grey area of, can you treat women? So clearly they could.
How interesting.
They were there.
What was your favourite herb?
The one that most intrigued me was bitter vetch. So... and it has a brilliant scarlet flower, so it's very noticeable. So harvesting it in autumn, it's a bulb, and you dry it. And some of the early tourists in the lowland Scotland comment on the bunch of bitter vetch by the door of the crofts, or hovels, as they like to call them. And what the bitter vetch did was, if you took a slice of it and chewed it, it tastes a bit like licorice. It suppresses appetite. And it also reduces thirst as well. So it's just the ideal herb for bridging the hungry gap. The hungry gap is from kind of February through to June, February, March to June. So all your saved herbs, stored food, gets you through Christmas and gets you kind of into the really early spring days. And then everything begins to sprout.
Comes the fast, you know, the
Lent. Absolutely.
Is Danish the Lent is called the fast, and that was the time when people fasted because of, as you say, they didn't have as many supplies, but also it's the perfect time to do a detox.
Without doubt. And of course, with the Christians thinking, you know, setting up Lent as a time to give up things, I mean, it matches quite nicely.
Yeah, yeah.
So the bitter vetch was just something that the lowland Scots used to get through the lean time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, one piece of bitter vetch would last, you know, would suppress your appetite for quite a few days.
How interesting. But ooh, I must try that next time, because I tend to fast in the spring. After a while, you're not hungry anymore, but just the beginning of it, the first few days, you feel quite hungry. How interesting. And of course, in earlier times, when there weren't corner shops and supermarkets and so on, our eating habits must have been very different, because you couldn't just satisfy your hunger every hour of every day like we do now.
No, exactly. But I mean, I find it quite intriguing that so-called poor people would be living on porridge, certainly up there, and vegetables, mm-hmm. and a little bit of meat if they could catch a rabbit or a deer. But as a rule, monks tended to be really quite well fed, and they would have had a high protein diet, with high blood pressure and associated you know, gout and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and there's, it's funny you say that, because there is the bishop's weed. Do you know that one? It's a ground elder. It's also called bishop's weed, and you use it specifically for gout. And I think it's amusing that it was the bishops that had the gout, because they were the well-fed part of the population.
The name gives it away, exactly who's going to use it most.
Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but that was absolutely fascinating to hear about your studies. And your book is called A Window on Medieval Medicine. Where can I buy that, if you'd like to buy that, Sarah?
Well, it's going to be on Amazon, or you can approach me through the Medicine Garden website. So my website is medicine-garden.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Sarah. I'll let you get back, because you're practicing today, aren't you? So I just called you in again.
I must go to work. But thank you very much for inviting me to talk about this book. I've really enjoyed it.
You're very welcome.
Unseen, unseen, not a glimpse of green. Who knows where it lies, if it lives or if it dies. Somewhere there among the thorns, somewhere out there in the storm. Tread lightly, for you tread on the tree of tomorrow. Slow roots growing down, curling, coiling underground. Who can see where it lies, far beneath these darkened skies? A tiny shoot, a tip of green, piercing through from the unseen. Tread lightly, lest you tread on the tree of tomorrow. Without a doubt, it's seen the spring when blossom is king. It stands alone, so straight and tall, but who cares if it lives at all? Make a space, make a place where it can grow. It's not just for show. Tread lightly and make way for the tree of tomorrow. Its trunk is strong, its branches spread, a shelter for the living and the dead. Did you lend a hand? Did you feed the land? Did you live your life with more than just strife? The seasons turn so we can learn from the laughter and the tears all through the year. Tread lightly and look up to the tree of tomorrow. Thank you.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. My name is Kirsten Hartwig, and this is the Herbal Medicine Show. I have found my old friend Keith Robertson in Ireland, which is another part of the Celtic heritage in herbal medicine. And hello, Keith.
Hello there.
You're out in Ireland teaching, but you're not Irish.
No, I'm born on the island of Arran in Scotland.
You still have a place there, don't you?
Yes, we have a herb farm and a teaching school. Drimlabara means the hill of the rough grazing.
And you grow herbs there and have people come and learn herbal medicine? And
yeah, we have a two-month apprenticeship, which kind of fills up a year in advance. And then we have shorter courses, like two-week-long, what we're calling Celtic Herbal Medicine Intensives. Danny O'Rourke, who I'm teaching for in Belfast this weekend, comes over. And along with Nicola D. Kelly from Wales, we provide a two-week intensive into the Celtic herbs.
Well, what would I learn if I went on that course?
Well, we got interested in the Celts, being Celts herself, having that history. And we're interested in them because of their beliefs. The Celts believed everything was alive, that everything was sacred, so mountains and rivers and streams and lakes and were all alive and were sacred and should be protected. The animals should be protected as well, and that women in society were the equal of men. There was no position was barred to women in Celtic society, and we think that whole just everything resonates with us in terms we believe in as a sort of vegan practitioners and egalitarians.
Wonderful. Because you have been a vegan for 30 years or something, so you're finally becoming trendy, Keith.
Yeah, well, I was born vegan, but my parents didn't notice, you see.
So plants, presumably, you see as sacred as well as the hills and the animals. And
Yeah, so we started, Danny and I were both at a conference. He founded a conference in Ireland, akin to Herb Fest. You've maybe heard of the festival, Herb Fest in England. Well, when he founded his one in Ireland, they called it Herb Feast. And the first one was a vegan sit-down dinner for 60 people. That has continued. So I was teaching for that. I was teaching on that conference a couple of years ago. And we were standing there looking out at the Celtic heartland, and we thought, this is our heritage, you know. Western herbalists keep being told by Chinese herbalists and Ayurvedic practitioners that we don't have a heritage, we don't have an energetic system, we don't have this, we don't have that. But actually, in that moment, we realised that we do. A crow in the background there. Hello, crow. So we thought, well, how do we research this? And we've just produced a book, Celtic Herbal Medicine, with Danny O'Rourke and myself. And Danny's a historian and scholar and amazing herbalist in Ireland. And so we've looked back at the history, at the Romans and medieval history and that whole bit. And we thought, well, how do we research the plants? And a lot of what we do is contemplative. We do a lot of study just looking at, just being with the plants, spending time with the plants, looking at how they grow, tasting them. And that's how we've always taught. So when we came to the problem of how do we research the Celts, because the problem is that the Celts themselves didn't actually write anything down. It was part of their culture not to write down important stuff. You had to remember it. So there's not that much literature that you can actually go to. But what we thought was, well, the plants are still the same. Things like plantain and nettles and dandelion, we'd all been growing here throughout prehistory. And those are the plants that they would have used, most likely. And so that's how we're approaching it. That, yes, we've done historical studies, etc. But now we're looking at how do we use those plants from an experiential point of view, and that's the next stage of what we're doing.
Does the book describe individual plants as well as the overall picture?
Well, this is the first part of a series. We've called this a primer. And so it goes into the history of the Celts, and we've gone back into an elemental approach. And the elements were something that's been part of human history forever. You know, people living in a rural or agrarian society, living close to the land, have always had appreciation of the elements, because if you don't, then you die.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
And so we felt that was the way in, was to look at an elemental approach to what we do and to reawaken the connection, earth, wind, fire. You know, these elemental beings, which are part of us and make up the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of, modern science kind of disproved them in a way. And in some ways, the ideas held scientific progress back for a little bit. If you imagine the element of air, because it was an element, you couldn't divide it up. And so for many years, people wouldn't accept it was made up of different gases. But what we want to do is we want to take that modern scientific approach, that meld it back into that kind of soul meeting that we have when we talk about the elements. So again, we're going through a process of earth, water, air, fire, and then we've added back in the ether. Science sort of disproved the need for an ether, but now that we've realized that what we've been studying, the atoms and the physical universe, make up only 4% of the actual universe now. That's what modern science is saying, that the physical world that we've been studying is only 4% of the actual universe, and the rest of dark energy and dark matter, you know. So we do need to re-enliven the idea of an ether element, and the ether element for us is what holds, it would be the soul of a human being or spirit, but it's also the information-rich universe that quantum mechanics has given.
How beautiful. And so how do you relate that to plants?
Well, in a basic way that we'd look at the earth element and the plant as the roots, the underground element of the plant. The stem is water. And most people have an ongoing experiment with their house plants where they don't water them for a while to see what happens. It's called torturing. It's amazing how quickly they recover if we get them soon enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
The water pressure is what the plant needs to stand upright.
Yeah.
And then
that's
the leaves,
so clever, isn't it? I mean,
that's amazing. Water's brilliant. And then we have the leaves, which are the air element, because you're exchanging the gases, are exchanging from the leaves, the oxygen, the carbon dioxide are going in and out of that. And then we have the flower, this amazing fiery element in the flower, these bright colours. Flowers are often, the temperature inside a flower is often slightly higher on the outside,
mm-hmm.
which can add heat to things if they want to. And then the ether element for us is the seed and the perfume and the genetics and the epigenetics, the soul of the plant. So we're saying the universe is information rich. That's what quantum mechanics is telling us. There's a huge amount of information out there. And that's what we feel that we could connect into.
Mm-hmm.
Because the universe seems to know what's going on. Every part of the universe seems to know what every other part of the universe is doing some weird way. What we're saying is that the universe is holographic, so every part of the universe contains the whole universe, information.
Yeah.
And so what we're hoping to do is, if we spend enough time with the plant, then we connect to the plant inside of us.
Yeah.
That makes
sense. Absolutely. So, well, it's like the old American, Native American culture, isn't it? Saying yeah. exactly that. So wonderful yeah. that you found that in the Celtic, you know, in your own Celtic tradition as well.
Yeah, yeah. The Native Americans believed that a plant overcame problems in its life and its growing, and it could pass that understanding on to humans. So we've seen that with something like willow, which grows in really boggy, wet, damp conditions. And it's so flexible, and in the human being, it relieves boggy, damp, stuck arthritis and gives back flexibility to the human being.
How brilliant. So now it's autumn. It's the root time of the year now, isn't it? So if you're going to choose your favourite root from your from your own Celtic experience, what would that be then?
Yeah, well, I mean, we can tend to get caught up in the exotic. But, I mean, you take something like dandelion roots. It's the most incredible herb, one of the most incredible herbs you can use, you know.
What would you use that for?
Well, I mean, we know dandelion root, it works, you know, on the digestion and the liver, and but it's been shown to be one of a really potent anti-cancer medicine. It's just... And so what we're saying is the earth energy in the human being is represented mainly by the digestive system, because it's your indoor garden, and the bones. So, and if people's digestion is out, then it's the root of everything. It's the root of the human being. And so if that's out, then nothing can be. Mm-hmm. Nothing can be. So it's just such an amazing plant to help with people digest properly and get back onto a level of fitness.
Yeah.
And an awareness of their food. So, yeah.
So how would you use it?
Well, just as a tea, even, you know, you can make a coffee out of it. You can roast it if you want to. It improves the taste and makes it a little bit sweeter. And you could drink that instead of coffee.
Yes, of course.
Coffee being a, you know, sort of problematic thing in the human being, I think. And a problematic thing in the world where it's traded and, you know, creates misery for some people.
So, yeah, you're right about that too. So yeah. We should exchange coffee for dandelion coffee, and that it has the same kind of bitter taste, hasn't it, like coffee, just minus the caffeine, but with a lot of other very healthy.
Yeah, it's a really helpful thing. Just watch buying it at some shops. Some of them have lactose in the coffee mix.
Ah, yeah.
You'd better buying dried or dig up your own roots, chop them up, and then gently roast them under the grill. Yeah, wonderful aroma comes off it as you're doing that, just gently. If you're digging your own, then chop them up before you dry them, or you won't be able to chop them up. There's a sweetness to it, but it also just has this amazing action in the human being.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Keith, for letting us into your amazing plant-based universe. Just remind me, what's the title of your book?
The title of the book is Celtic Herbal Medicine by Danny O'Rourke. It's only available from us at the moment, but if people go to veganherbal.com and contact us through that, we can post stuff out to you.
Wonderful. Well, I better let you get back to your students. And thank you very much for this.
Okay, Kirsten.
My hands cannot hold. The world's on its side, and the gold's not real gold. My voice is so muted, my choices are bruited, and my heart
is so still and so cold. The lines of my story are creased in my skin. Victory's brief glory, defeat's broken ring. My breath it comes sharp and my eyes they grow dark as my heart is tossed on the wind. Oh, I'd better go quickly, I'd better go now, I'd better go down to the stream. There's nothing so dry as this rainless sky, and the world is burning my dreams. I'm feeling the pull from invisible strings. My cup's not yet full, but the day still begins. The moonlight is failing, the starlight is fading, and my heart's still waiting in the wind. Tailor-made for me, watching the way that's unfolding before me. In each twist and turn, I learn and unlearn as my heart tries so hard to restore me. I'd better go quickly, I'd better go now, I'd better go down to the stream. There's nothing so dry as this rainless sky, and the world is blind to my dream. Now my feet feel so weary from the journey's steep climb, and I'm sure, well nearly, that I followed each sign. The road is still calling, the autumn is falling, and my heart, it beats out of time. Bring back the thunder that's been lost for years. Bring back the thunder, don't hold back your tears. In the lightning storm, in the dark before dawn, my heart is free from all fear. And I'm going quickly, oh, I'm going now, I'm going down to the stream. There's nothing so dry as this rainless sky, but the world will wake to my dreams.
So we've been to Scotland and Ireland in this show down the history of herbal medicine. And now I've gone to Wales, where I have found Nicola Kelly. And I've contacted Nicola because I know that she is an expert on the Welsh heritage of herbal medicine. Hi, Nicola, are you with us?
Hi. Yes.
Excellent. Very pleased to have you on the show, Nicola. And I'm going to chicken out of pronouncing the physicians of Wales herbal medicine. Can you do that for me, please?
The physicians of Mudfy.
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 And they were herbalists, weren't they? More than physicians, herbalists. Or were they both?
It's a long family line that dates back to, well, medieval times and even before. And there's a lovely story that where they came from a lady of the lake.
And you have been working with her because you're a medical herbalist.
I've been working in the Botanic Garden of Wales for many years to do with the history of plants in medicine. And living, and all my children grew up very close to Mavfi. So we did a lot of investigating into the herbs that they used, and still proving that we use them all today, even though a lot of them have been forgotten. And we've been trying to listen to local people, asking them what herbs their grandmothers used and their aunties and Mrs. Jones from down the road, because a lot of things were not written down in Welsh. It was just a family passed down from the families. The physicians worked for the monasteries and the kings and princes, and they didn't share their knowledge the same because it was kept elite. But most of it came from the old folk medicine anyway, that was from local people. We had separate people in each village. There'd be one lady who looked after inflammations, another one that made poultices, another one would make stuff for the waterworks, one would know about mushrooms. It would be a communal thing, medicine, and it's still many, many normal people, everyday people, would know all sorts of things that their grandmothers used constantly. We seem to have lost it over the years, where everything was passed down just by word of mouth.
And so how have you used that in your practice, or have you been teaching it? Or?
Both. Well, I've been in practice in Wales since 2004, but then working up in Scotland as well, and helping run the Medicines in May, a whole month based on history of plants in medicine in the National Botanic Garden of Wales, getting children involved and whole families of what we were using through the ages, what plants grow around you, to go and pick them, prepare them like they used to use in that century, and like posies for the plague and all sorts of exciting things, and things in the war, what you would have done if you didn't have the modern medicine. You still got a set of bone, you've used comfrey and a comfrey poultice, and also a splint and all the other things for boils and drawing ointments and all the exciting things that we've just forgotten to use when they all work so wonderfully. Well, I'm still using comfrey, which they called knit bone, all hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And we're still using it. I still get people to dig up the roots and make poultices from them, smash them up with a hammer and do it all. And it does work. It works so quickly. It sets it faster than any other way the allopathic works. You just have to make sure that you've put the bone in the right position. That's why there were bone setters. There was whole families that passed down through the generations, the bone setters in the village.
How amazing. So people helped each other, and they didn't have, I suppose everyone had their sort of profession within the professions then. So there were the bone setters and the poultice makers. And
yes, well, I find that they pay each other a little bit, if you had it, a couple of pennies or something, which was not only cheaper than the doctors or the quacks or whatever they call them, it's not only cheaper than them, but it would guarantee to work. I don't know why we lost faith in them, but I suppose it was just outruled. Most people were outruled, weren't they? And because the Welsh language was outlawed, then a lot of that interfered with it. People were beaten for speaking their own language. So therefore
really?
They weren't allowed to pass in Wales, even in when there's a couple of elderly people that I know, they were beaten in school for talking to their brother in Welsh when they spoke Welsh as first language at home. And they're only in their 80s now, but they had trouble for years. It's only in the last maybe 40 years or 30 years even that Welsh language has been allowed to be prolific again, and it's actually supported. Whereas before, they were, you just had to not speak your own language, which is terrible. It lost so much in all the stories that were passed down.
Yeah, and if it was an oral history, that must have been absolutely...
And the book, The Physicians of Maathai, was written in Welsh, obviously, and they took a lot of their knowledge, not only from their own people, the traditional people, they took from the Greeks and the Romans, and that's slightly debating whether the Greeks and the Romans took it from the Celts. I think probably Kiesel, I'll contest that the Celts were a lot more developed than is being acknowledged.
Maathai physicians, were they a particular family or was it a place? Or
Well, Maathai is a place in Dyfed in Carmarthenshire in Wales. But it all comes from the Lady of the Lake. So I find that a lot of the stories from all over the world that say that there's people from the water that bring the knowledge. So then the Lady of the Lake is a lovely story about a lady who comes out of the water and talks to a lonely shepherd boy with his cows up in the field. And he keeps going back and he'd seen this lady come out of the lake and eventually gets to speak to her and marries her. And the story comes on that the children from those became the physicians of Maathai. And that long line still carried on to a John Jones, which has just finished. They carried the knowledge. She kept coming out even as she'd gone back into the lake. It is amazing because apparently she passed all this knowledge on to the sons
about how to use the herbs that surrounded them.
How to treat people. All the medical knowledge got passed to them and passed down. The water has a memory, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Water has memory, and all sorts of vibrations, like the Masamo Emoto. Says that the crystals of the water, if you treat it or you speak unkindly to it, it will have a certain vibration. If you send love into it, the crystals will form perfectly into a beautiful snowflake.
Mm.
So I suppose that's, and it's like our knowledge chain as well. If we need to keep it clean and keep our water clean inside and outside.
Yeah.
Does make sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. That's a beautiful way of looking at it. So we, at this time of year, Nicola, this is in sort of in energetic terms, I see this time of year as roots because everything goes down, back down into the earth.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in roots this week. So which is your favourite root?
Comfrey root. I would say comfrey or burdock. Burdock for cleansing, deep, deep cleansing on many levels with comfrey for healing. I've put it on that as a poultice as well, on horses' legs as well as people's breasts to pull out tumours.
So can you, like a
drawing
cream or whatever you'd call it?
I use comfrey, burdock as a drawing thing. It can be drawing out of the body from the inside or from the outside.
How interesting.
It's a very, very powerful being and one of my favourites, burdock.
Yeah.
You can take the leaf as a tea. You can eat the root. You can roast the roots and eat them. I use, as I say, in poultices, I use the leaves as part of the poultice, not only chopped into mixing up with slippery elm and calendula and garlic and things for pulling infections out.
So you sort of it's like a mesh you make of them?
Yes. And I'd also use the leaf, the big leaf, to put it in and then put that over the wound.
Mm. So you use it for wounds and...
Pulling out... Well, I had cellulitis... a bad case of cellulitis a lady had in her breast, and that's what I used a lot of burdock on that, and the leaf to use it for the actual plaster for it,
mm-hmm.
to hold it and pull it, draw it out, and that worked amazingly.
So how did it come out? I mean...
It drew. I was putting poultices on 4 times a day, and it was pulling it. It just pulled it, and it pulled it all into a...
like a boil or something?
A small ball, and then all of a sudden it pulled it through the skin, it opened it and just drained it, and that's what they would have done in the hospital anyway. They would have just cut her open and put a drain in and full of antibiotics. That's what they said they'd do to her. Flush it with antibiotics and keep draining it, just leave it open with a drain in. And she was not willing to do that and wanted me to do it. So we did this poultice, and it pulled it, it just drew it out, opened it when it was ready, and we carried on, and then it closed it afterwards. So it was, you're still doing the same thing, but you're not being brutal about it. You're letting the body, you're giving medicine from the inside that helps draw everything together, push out what's not, what shouldn't be in the body, healing at the same time, and ejecting what is not, what doesn't belong there. Burdock, they used a lot for psoriasis, the physicians of Maasai did, and we still do. They used the leaves of burdock, pounded them with a little wine, and then strained them. They took 3 spoonfuls at night, in the morning, and at noon, and let the decoction of burdock be your only drink. The part should be fermented with the decoction also, as hot as you can bear it, and anoint it afterwards with an unguent composed of wine, olive oil, and honey. So they did have those things in that time.
Yeah, how interesting. And that was for psoriasis, which is notoriously difficult to treat.
Well, psoriasis, burdock does respond, is very good with psoriasis, because psoriasis often is a long-term thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas eczema can, you'll get a serious... If you give too much burdock to a child or person with eczema, you might get a very bad healing reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't need that kick, where psoriasis can be long and old and deep toxins or deep
chronic
stagnancy.
Yeah.
So it needs a real kick, and burdock does do that. It'll give that shift that you need on many levels. I find it's quite as an emotional one and a spiritual one, it will give that shift. So it's a very good friend.
Yeah. Well, that's a very nice way of describing it, because it also, when you look at burdock, it looks like it would, it's a very strong plant to look at, and the burrs that stick to you, and it's a very insistent plant, isn't it?
Yes, it even sticks to your skin.
Yeah.
And to stick to your hair, if any gardener knows, with children who think it's funny to throw them at you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, Nicola. It's been fascinating to hear the story of how you practice the old fashioned Welsh medicine of Mudwai.
Well, one day I can read you the Physicians of Mudwai in a Welsh accent, if you like.
We've come to the end of this week's Herbal Medicine Show, brought to you as usual by Heartwood Herbal Education. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Sarah Atkinson, Keith Robertson, and Nicola Kelly for taking us back in herbal times to a place where herbs were at the center of medicine, and bringing them back to life today. Thank you to Nick Rowley and Peter Firebrace for the music, and to Steve Thomas and Nick from the Heartwood production team for superb technical support. Please join me again next week for another dose of plant power.